Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
How lovely to be here. I'm going to talk today about one of the oldest stories from the Buddhist tradition. This is a story from the Pali Canon, and the Pali Canon is so named because Pali is the language in which it was written down. This stuff was written down 300 years after, approximately, after the Buddha died. And Pali may have been the language that he spoke, although we're not quite sure. And this tradition was passed down word to mouth for 300 years, memorized and spoken only, for there was no written form of Pali until 300 years after his death. So, last week we had work practice here, which was quite lovely. About 10 of us stayed after the talk and after tea and spent several hours doing mindful work in the yard and around the building, taking care of our place. And this is how I remember this. Someone sent me outside and said, go work in the yard. So I looked outside and I saw Ted looked like he knew what he was doing. So I said, Ted, what should I do? And he said, well, why don't you rake the leaves up out of the beds and put them in a bag, in bags, and take them up by the trash, and the city will get them. We've already got enough for the compost. So I started doing that, and I did that for about an hour. And then Hugh came up, and Hugh said, Ben, what should we do with these leaves? And I said, well, I think we should put them in bags and put them up by the trash. That's what Ted told me to do. And he said, well, Ted just asked me what to do with the leaves. Now, I may not be the sharpest tool in the shed. But Hugh is working on a doctorate. And Ted has a law degree. And between the three of us, in 1 hour, something happened. Something quite wonderful, really. And so this just made me think of 300 years of memorization and just how accurate the Pali Canon might be. And, you know, I say this because this tradition is not about receiving and accepting something from someone who is perfect. As Suzuki Roshi said, it's not about getting teaching out of the refrigerator. It's about working the bare soil itself. And so I bring up this story to just remind us that this is about engaging with these teachings and with our lives and our practice, directly bringing to life this tradition ourselves. So having said that, I'm going to talk about the Pali Canon. And I had to give this this little introduction to distract you from the fact that I'm going to talk about the same sutra Guy talked about last week. So, I'm going to talk about what's known as the first discourse of the Buddha, generally thought to contain what most people would say is like the most fundamental teaching of Buddhism. And it is reasonable to think that this is one of the closer teachings to what he actually taught, because over and over again throughout the Pali Canon, it refers back to this teaching. This is actually why I decided to give this talk. I kept looking in my book of the Pali Canon about really interesting esoteric things, and it kept saying, oh yes, go back to the first step. I kept being reminded to just return to this basic teaching of Buddhism, which is the alleviation of suffering through ethical action and meditation. Let me just read the first line of this thing, because that's fun. Thus I have heard. At least they're honest. If you read a Mahayana Sutra, it says, the Buddha preached from the golden lotus platform as radiant light emanated. Yeah, well, so anyway, the Pali Canon, which is great. You got to read this stuff. It's very, it fills you with a light when you read the Mahayana Sutras and some other things. But anyway, thus I have heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was staying at Varanasi in the game refuge at Isipatana. There he addressed the group of five monks. So I don't want to set the stage very much, but there it was a big thing in India at the time to practice. People were looking for basically the meaning to life or the solution to human suffering, the solution to the problem of life and death. It was a big thing. There were lots of people devoting themselves to this. And he was coming back to a group of five people he'd done a lot of this with. They had in particular been doing a lot of extremely ascetic practices, not eating for so long that they almost died. That's a good way to alleviate suffering, by the way. Seems counterintuitive, but, they tried it and they committed themselves to it. Also not breathing for an incredible length of time. So all these really extreme ascetic practices. And the first thing that he says, this is his first teaching. There are these two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth, which basically means someone who is on the path to a spiritual life, I guess. That which is devoted to sensual pleasure in sensual objects, and that which is devoted to self-affliction. So, the middle way is the middle way. And the middle way is really interesting, but I don't want to talk about it very much here. I will say that in this case, he's talking about not starving yourself to death. So if you ever feel like you're going overboard with your ascetic practice here at the Zen Center, remember that we eat three meals a day. And after he said that you shouldn't starve yourself to death, supposedly these people only ate one meal a day for the rest of their lives. So we're not really falling over too far into the ascetic side of things here, I don't think. But it is interesting that the first thing that he speaks of is moderation. Moderation. So, avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way was realized by the Tathagata. That's how the Buddha referred to himself. It's a less flashy name than Buddha, which means kind of like enlightenment. It basically means what you see here. Literally means thus come and thus gone. So what you see appearing and disappearing here, that's how he referred to himself, Tathagata. So avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way realized by the Tathagata, producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. And what is the middle way realized by the Tathagata that producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding? Precisely this eightfold path, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right meditation. It's funny because if I had asked most of the people in this room what they thought the first teaching was, they would have said the first thing was suffering. I think. But it isn't. It's what to do. So he'll get to suffering, don't worry. Because this is about alleviating suffering. Insofar as life is pretty good, well, that's cool. Hang out with it. Insofar as there is suffering, let's do something about it. So when we say right view, right intention, right is a, in this thing it's translated from a prefix, sama, which could alternately be translated as perfect, complete, coherent, There's no nice English word for it, but it does not quite have as much connotation as right and wrong as it does holistic. People will often say wholesome. I don't like wholesome because the only time I ever heard it used was in Wonder Bread ads on television. So it doesn't really work for me. I grew up in the 70s. I don't watch TV anymore, okay? So, holistic, we'll just throw this in one time. Holistic view, holistic intention. I was trying to find something out about right view. Most of the sutras I could find said what right view is the view that is contained in this teaching, which is there's suffering. Suffering is caused by desire. There is an end to suffering, and that end to suffering is the Eightfold Path. So this teaching is really enfolded. In general, right view could be thought to be a view that is big, much bigger than the narrow view that we go through most of our life with, which is pretty much focused on what we're trying to get or our ideas that we've carried around for a long time. So right view and right intention kind of go together, because right view is principally, in this teaching, it's seeing that suffering is here and that there's a way out of it. Right intention is when your heart wakes up and you want to do something about it. So right view is more about your mind, the way you are thinking about things. And right intention is about your heart waking up when you see that suffering and it's being motivated to do something. To do something with this. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. Right speech and right livelihood are forms of action. But I think the fact that they are here separated out suggests that they seemed important. Particularly important. Speech is very powerful. As anyone who's ever been in an argument and notice how certain turns of phrase that can cause lots of problems knows. Speech is very powerful. So right speech, right action, and right livelihood. We're talking about ethics. We're talking about acting ethically. And ethics is a big question. So I don't want to... I will say that ethics is... We don't have commandments in this tradition. So we have to... We have to work with what's here. We do have a large body of study of ethics that you can come hang out here and you'll hear more about it. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation, sometimes translated as concentration. I don't want to do that today because you can concentrate a lot of things and it has nothing to do with what this is talking about. Right concentrated meditation might be more accurate. So, mindfulness, probably most of the people are here familiar with the basic idea of drawing your attention to this moment. And meditation is a big part of what we do here. So, I think it's interesting that right effort, right intention, which is just about really feeling this sense of wanting to do something, comes before the right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And then the very active sounding one, right effort, comes before right mindfulness and right meditation, which is what we practice by not moving at all. But really there is effort in our sitting. When we sit here, your body is upright. It's a physical activity. We may start to be really focused on what's happening in our mind, but sitting is a very physical practice. And it really is about embodying this piece. So he says, what is the middle way that leads to unbinding? It is this Eightfold Path. This is the middle way realized by the Tathagata, that producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge,
to self-awakening, to unbinding. So he goes on, or the sutra goes on. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is stressful, aging... wrong translation, sorry. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair are suffering. Association with things disliked is suffering. Separation from things liked is suffering. Not getting what one wants is suffering. In short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. I'm just going to ignore the last sentence because it's kind of technical and complicated. The idea that birth is suffering is rather confounding to me. And I think it would be complicated to talk about. But I will say that once you are born, there will be suffering. You probably haven't met anyone who's been born who's never suffered. Usually around here we talk about... this word suffering, we're talking... The Sanskrit word is dukkha. The Pali word is dukkha. Sometimes translated as dissatisfaction. Oftentimes we just talk about association with things disliked. And that is something we get to spend a lot of time doing. I like associating with slowly loading web pages. That's one right there. Aging, you know, people talk to me about their bodies not doing what they used to be able to do, and it's difficult. Watching someone that you love do something over and over again that causes them to suffer. And wishing that they would change. Wishing they would change. There's the suffering. Death. If you've had anyone that you love die, you know suffering. I think it's interesting here that it doesn't say anything about your suffering or my suffering or our suffering. This says, this is part of the deal. And it's universal. And we might get thinking like, oh, I'm trying to alleviate my suffering. Or I want to devote myself to alleviate others' suffering. But those distinctions are not real. This world of suffering, this pattern of suffering, is the word for it is samsara. Samsara is the world of suffering. And it is, we are asked to let this in. We're asked to let this in. We're not asked to be attracted to suffering, but to not avoid it. There's a beautiful practice called Tonglen, in which it's a meditation practice that enables us to just touch suffering without holding on to it, without pulling towards it or pushing it away. Because it's real. It's a part of life, and we spend an enormous amount of time trying to avoid suffering. Especially with mental activity. You know? I don't actually think about how I'm suffering, I just think about how that other guy is stupid. Right? And that helps, as everyone knows. So I used to live with Billy and Little Bear. I think you would say that Billy was kind of an introvert, and Little Bear was kind of an extrovert. Billy weighed about 8 pounds, and Little Bear weighed about 45. And they lived together most of their lives.
and they've rarely interacted. They lived in the same apartments and houses, but they mostly kept to themselves. But Billy, or Little Bear, being an extrovert, would sometimes approach Billy. And Little Bear had known Billy long enough that she would try and assume the most unaggressive, unthreatening stance that a huge furry dog could have to a little tiny cat. And she would inch forward to be close to Billy. And she just wanted to be close to her. She wasn't even going to try and play. She knew that more. She just wanted to be physically proximate. Just to be a couple feet away and sleep. 2 feet away was, you could see Billy, our Little Bear, just wanted her so much. And Billy would lie there. Billy did a lot of lying around. Billy would lie there. And then she wouldn't really register much. And then suddenly, Little Bear would just cross some spatial threshold, and Billy would just get up and walk away. And that was the bulk of the way those two beings interacted. Although I would be willing to be corrected on that. So then Billy got really sick, and Billy died. And that was hard to watch. Her body became nothing like the incredibly dynamic body that it once was. And she was so sick. And then she died. And she's buried in my backyard. And Little Bear, after she died, couldn't find Little Bear. So, and Little Bear was not out, like, we didn't have a, you couldn't go outside, Little Bear. Little Bear would eat every dog in the neighborhood if you let her outside. So we looked throughout the house to find Little Bear. And eventually we found her. She was behind, in a tiny space, behind the radiator, or behind the furnace. I'd never seen her before. And she was shaking. Shaking. How long had she been back there by herself shaking? She was grieving. So profoundly. I would come home from work, and she would be back there again. And after a few weeks, she never went back there again. Well, maybe a couple times. But you could see, physically, the suffering of that dog at that loss. So, you could say that Billy wanted space, and Little Bear wanted closeness. And that was hard for both of them. One would try and get the one, and the other would try and get the other. But finally, there was this love there. And that love caused them to suffer while they were alive, and it caused them to suffer when Billy died. And this is part of the deal. This is part of the deal. I don't want to get overly negative here. But it's part of the deal. If you love something, you're going to suffer. You're also going to have a lot of other things. But that's part of it. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the origination of suffering. The desire that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now here and now there, desire for sensual pleasure, desire for becoming, desire for no becoming. So further becoming, this gets kind of, I yet again use the term technical early Buddhism has a lot of complicated terms. But let's say accompanied by passion and delight. I think that's interesting. If you love something, you're going to end up with the other side of it. That's what this teaching suggests. You know, you get to go on vacation. It's awesome. Wow, it's so fun. You come home and you go back to your job and you're like, I don't want to use that word. darn. You say, darn. Desire for sensual pleasure. Desire for becoming. So that's, you know, I want this to be. What I want is for everyone to love me. Or what I want is for everyone to leave me alone. Neither one probably works out. So, this basic idea that desire is the source of suffering, known as the second noble truth. So the first noble truth is suffering, and the second one is desire, is what creates this suffering. This is not about figuring out why other people are suffering. So you don't need to explain to other people when they're unhappy that it's just their attachment. This isn't a judgmental teaching. You know, when I saw Little Bear, you know, it didn't make me think, it's just desire. What I thought was, oh, God, I love you. That's what I thought. But it does point to the fact that most of the time when we're dealing with suffering, what we're likely to be doing is formulating a story about it that is set in our own kind of selfish view with which we're going to try and resolve the problem. And, you know, that has some value. You know, the walk is full of snow. I will shovel it. That's not bad. It's okay. The other side of it, though, is the walk is full of snow, and I hate shoveling, and this is annoying. And then I start thinking about my old ideas about this. I have a desire that I don't have to shovel, and I suffer. Hopefully I do actually shovel. This, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. The remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very desire. This teaching suggests that it is possible for suffering to end completely. That's the other side of it. I'll tell you this incredibly, what to me was a very sad story. This teaching suggests that there is an end to suffering. That's what it's about. It's not about suffering, and it's not about the end. It's about the whole thing. It's about seeing this whole big picture, this whole world arising with suffering in it, and the possibility of the cessation of that suffering. Now, I was talking about this to a friend of mine, and he said, gosh, cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, letting go. Can I have, like, joy or infinite bliss? I said, well, die and go to heaven. Actually, I didn't say that. Well, I just said it. But I do think, the reason this is stated in somewhat negative terms is because, you know, if we just go, you can go from bad to good, then it's much easier to just turn this process into the same system of desire that generates all the suffering. So it's a little bit like a trick. You know, it's a rhetorical device to allow us... I mean, if you think of letting go of suffering, then the process is less likely to be full of the desire that creates suffering. Instead of thinking, I'm getting joy. Oh, I wouldn't mind getting some joy. That's cool. And this... This remainderless fading of suffering is associated in this tradition with nirvana, the total dissolution of the self that creates suffering, which is a promise of this tradition. I personally have not met anyone who would tell me that they have stopped suffering completely. So I'm not going to talk about that very much. But it is a part of this tradition, and it is interesting. But it's kind of out of my ken. So, practically speaking, this is pretty common sense, I think. Wouldn't you think that practicing ethical action would be conducive to less suffering than practicing unethical action? I mean, it's not all that crazy of a teaching. The idea that meditation would be conducive to the cessation of suffering might be less intuitive to some people, but probably for most people around here. Experientially, most of us have tasted that truth. It might not be immediate gratification. There's not much talk about immediate gratification for yourself in this sutra. But if you direct yourself, if you begin to see the world as an opportunity to alleviate suffering through ethical action, I suspect you'll find that you suffer less and the people around you suffer less. So this body of teaching can get very mystical and wonderful in that way. But here it's quite possible to view this as just like, geez, you know, at this moment, I have a choice. I could either say something really curt and unpleasant to this person standing behind this counter because I am in a hurry and they are slow, and see what the effect of that is. Or I could observe the suffering I'm experiencing as suffering and say something kind and see which one is more conducive to the alleviation of suffering. This is a kind of experiment I highly encourage you to engage in. See what happens. We'll report back. Everyone do this for a year, and we'll have a study. I think we have some scientists here. So in the much later than this sutra, we have the Mahayana tradition comes along, which is kind of a different take on all this Buddhist thought and practice. It has many, many similarities, but it has some differences. And in the Mahayana tradition, we often say nirvana and samsara are one. So this teaching seems to suggest that there is suffering, and you do this, and then there's less suffering. Sounds kind of linear. And that's a very good way to view it. But it's not the only way. Now, the fact that nirvana and samsara are one can get pretty mysterious. Wait, I'm suffering and you're telling me I'm Buddha? I don't feel like Buddha. I'm the most angry Buddha you've ever met. It can be encouraging just in that way, though, when you're angry, because if you say, I am angry Buddha, it can help you to accept yourself as a valid part of the universe. And that's a good start. That's a good start. But I want to just talk about this: nirvana and samsara are one, in an almost practical way. And I'm just going to say that I think that if you commit yourself to this Eightfold Path, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right meditation. If you commit yourself to this path, and you are on this path, and you stay on this path, at some time, you will find yourself in a position where there is suffering. There is clearly suffering. It might be suffering that would conventionally be called your suffering, and it might be suffering that would conventionally be called another's suffering. But there will be suffering there. And you will know it. And in a moment, without thinking about it, without having all these words that I'm using, you will be totally aware of this suffering. You will be present to it. Your heart will be awake to the pain of it. And in that moment, you will do something kind. The essence of right speech, right action, is just kindness, compassionate kindness. You will do something kind. And even though this suffering that would normally be called your suffering or another suffering is right there, right there, you will taste, you will realize a vast, profound stillness that is very hard to explain and couldn't quite be characterized as joy, but that's not too far off. And you won't have all these words for it because it will happen just like that. And each one of these steps on this path will be awake. And each one of these truths will be awake in your life. And you will taste the truth of the utter simplicity towards which all these teachings are pointing. Thank you. And I would welcome your words, comments, questions, or whatever.
And the first time I actually sat down and read that sutra, I was really surprised to see that they started out talking about the Eightfold Path before Four Noble Truths. And I've been kind of rolling that around in my head ever since, because it's always taught in the other. Four Noble Truths, and then the last one is the Eightfold Path. What do you think about teaching it in one order versus another? Do you think it makes it different somehow, or do you think it changes the...
Yes, and you know what's funny is I actually forgot to do one. The fourth noble truth that comes after after sukha, the cessation of suffering, is what is the path? This, monks, is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering, precisely the noble eightfold path. So it comes back. But this, I thought of this, and I think of it very simply. I thought, I want to give this talk about this. This is so fundamental. But what am I going to do? I don't want to come in and start talking about suffering right away. Because you have to take the suffering into your life. This is about quitting denying it. But I don't want to just come in and be like, oh, yeah, my dog died. Right? So I thought, how do you make a narrative? A narrative works. You have to introduce the characters before you introduce the struggle. And so I was trying to think, how am I going to make this talk? I have to find some introduction. And then I read the sutra, and I said, oh, he did it for me. Never mind. Really, because So in that sense, just in that it enables us to enter in that way, it functions just the way narrative is supposed to function. And also, it's practical. You know what I mean? If you only read this far, you'll know what you're supposed to do. You know? So, yeah. Probably because when he says them as the Four Noble Truths, it's the fourth one. Mm-hmm. But so it's a very enfolded teaching. It's interesting in that because the first noble truth is the first step on the Eightfold Path basically is the Four Noble Truths. So it's enfolded. But I like the way this one does it better than the one that you read on Wikipedia.
It might be kind of a marketing thing too. Like culturally, it's easier to bring people in if they're clearly suffering, and it's simpler than the Eightfold Path.
Mm. Well, I mean, the truth of suffering is motivating, but what matters is that we do this. You know, if you don't think about suffering at all and you just are ethical and meditate, that's helpful. This is about living in a way that is helpful. It's part of the deal.
And what came to mind for me when you said the suffering of birth was, as a mother of two children, I personally have experienced the mother's side of the suffering of birth, and the magic of it. And then also, what really struck me when you said that was, my God, a baby when they're first born looks like they've been through hell. I mean, like sometimes they're out of shape, and I mean that birth process, like the mother's body is squeezing the life out of them. Hopefully not. For them to be born, and so clearly there's a lot of suffering in there, and it's a metamorphosis process. That's what those mental images came to mind when you were talking about that suffering.
Mm. And there's a really bright place, and there's all this noise, mm-hmm. and there's air, and there's all these vehicles, and it's like
just slapped down the front.
Seems like also the experience of division from, like, the first experience of division from the whole.
Mm.
And then we are fooled for a long time.
I heard recently Stephen Batchelor talking about exactly what you were talking about, but with the sequence of teaching, he suggests that it's wrong. Because he's like that, right?
He's like that.
Yeah. the sequence that is normally taught is wrong, beginning with the teaching of suffering. He suggests turning the whole thing on its head, where it's not that desire causes suffering, it's that when you suffer, that gives rise to the desire for things to change. And that desire is based on some egocentric thing that it's all about you, mm-hmm. and you desire for things to be different than that. But the Eightfold Path, you start there, and the Eightfold Path, if you practice it ethically, then you're self-centered, then the suffering doesn't happen. So
mm-hmm.
That's a six-hour talk in 2 minutes.
So you think it's really true that, like, anything that has real truth, you can turn it on its head and
absolutely
avert it,
right.
And it still makes sense.
Absolutely.
You know, suffering causes desire, desire causes suffering.
And he actually pointed out exactly what Ben pointed out, that it's a circular kind of thing. These things are not. It's not you start here and one leads to the next. It's that it's a
journey. I think I'm not off with you in that one.
Mm-hmm.
It's not related. All the teachings are contained in the other teachings.
I like the words of those desire, clinging, grasping, and clinging. Because even when we suffer, sometimes we cling to that. I mean, just it's counterintuitive. It's kind of volatile. You ever see yourself do that? Oh, like it becomes identity for us.
When we were talking about how teaching is all unfolded and looking at different ways you get to this, the other place, and then you use the word holistic for one interpretation of right. And when you said holistic, I started thinking of holograms. And, you know, holograms, supposedly, you take a little tiny piece of it, and you can see the whole thing in it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the way that Buddha teaching is the same way. You take a little tiny piece of it, and you go deep enough, and you see the whole thing. You put it back together, and see the whole thing.
And arguably, that's not just a characteristic of the Buddha's teaching, but of consciousness. Anything you look at, the whole thing is there. I mean, the big whole thing. Stars, wallets, birds. Anyone else?
I wanted to. You brought up something that happened for me. You had said, when you see the suffering and it opens up, that it opens it all up. What do you do with it once it opens it up? Because what I saw was a 2-week infant that was being fitted for hearing aids, but she couldn't hear. Being worn out. And that moved me so much and wanted to do something kind. But the best thing I can do is just be loving and kindness to the universe. And that just doesn't seem enough sometimes. So that brings up more suffering because there's that desire to get rid of the suffering and extinguish the suffering and take the bodhisattva vows even further.
Mm-hmm.
And then it opens it all, falls away, and then it's like, oh! What do you do?
What do you do?
You just sit with it.
That's one of the things I do, is just sit with it. It is important to be careful not to be overwhelmed by suffering. I think that's, you know, and that happens. I get overwhelmed by suffering. You know, I listen to the radio in my car driving to work, and I usually cry. But the thing is, I cry for a minute because something is happening that's just god-awful to a lot of people. And then I let that go, and I go on to the next thing. But sometimes I do get overwhelmed, and that's not what we're being asked to do here. And, you know, all these things, the Sangha is here to support us. If you do these things, you practice this Eightfold Path, you practice, like you said, you come back and just sit, you practice your mindfulness and your meditation, and you know that brings you back into some stillness. So we don't want to get totally carried away by this. And it's something to pay attention to. But, you know, he talks of the middle way. Avoiding it doesn't work, but clinging to it doesn't work. What's the answer? That's what we get to live, is the answer to that question.